been their home now for over 50 days. Such patrols were to continue until April 30th, and a communist soldier was made a prisoner during the course of a patrol as late as May 1st. In Paris, the Journal Officiel, a daily government publication which fills the role of both the American Congressional Record and the Federal Register, and which had published on Saturday the official promotion to the next higher rank of most of the officers at Dien Bien Phu, this day carried the text of Decision No. 18, dated April 17th, citing the whole garrison of Dien Bien Phu in the dispatches of the French army, and awarding it the Croix de Guerre, with palms for overseas operations. Those men who would survive the battle would henceforth be able to wear a blue and red foragère as a sign of that unit citation. The final paragraph of the citation read as follows. United in the will to win, officers, non-commissioned officers, corporals, and soldiers deserved the admiration of the free world, with the pride and gratitude of France. Their courage shall remain an example forever. In his reply to General Navarre's message of the previous day, General Cogny estimated that Dien Bien Phu could last another 2 to 3 weeks if it received reinforcements and if the enemy should decide not to launch a general attack. If the reinforcements were to be stopped, Cogny estimated that resistance would collapse within 8 days because of the drop in combat morale. He also recommended that for the week to come, reinforcements be limited to individual volunteers and that a full parachute of Foreign Legion Battalion be dropped in later. Cogny considered Condor useful if it were to be initiated without delay. But he again disagreed with his commander-in-chief as to the usefulness of continuing the agony of Dien Bien Phu at the expense of the reinforcement of the Red River Delta. In his own words, "I absolutely reject the hypothesis of reinforcing Dien Bien Phu simply to increase the moral value of the sacrifice." Cogny based his estimate of the situation on the simple fact that the moral value or the psychological benefit derived from a prolonged resistance of Dien Bien Phu would mean very little in the context of a general deterioration of the situation, particularly in the key Red River Delta. Both commanders were caught, each one at his own level, in an irreconcilable dilemma. The agony and full public view of the garrison of Dien Bien Phu at least served as a painful prod to France, the United States, and Great Britain that something had to be done about the Indochina problem, whether at the conference table or through direct American military intervention. The very drama of the situation called for quick decisions that the unspectacular deterioration throughout the rest of Indochina had until now permitted the West to avoid, even if, in the long run, it was potentially far more dangerous than the fall of Dien Bien Phu itself. Hence, to Navarre, who had seen the situation from the overall viewpoint, and who had to remain responsive to the views of Paris, Dien Bien Phu at the moment was more important than the Red River Delta, because the former represented a capital of political leverage that the latter simply did not possess. On the following day, Navarre again was to attempt to explain this to his reluctant commander in the north. As night fell that Sunday over Dien Bien Phu, the headquarters staff at Dien Bien Phu began, as always, to transmit its routine reports on the supply situation. As usual, there was an urgent need for more medical corpsmen to take care of the ever-growing hordes of seriously wounded. There were serious shortages of medical supplies of all kinds. In the past, bottles of fresh blood, which had been parachuted in packs of dry ice and had been misdropped, deteriorated and became unusable before they could be found. But on April 15th and 18th, Dien Bien Phu received 2 parachuted blood banks, which at least permitted the doctors to draw blood directly from volunteers in the garrison. There was also the routine request for trench periscopes, since direct daytime observation had become a hopelessly lethal occupation now that Dien Bien Phu was tightly surrounded by enemy snipers and recoilless rifles. Once more, also, supply pleaded for flak jackets for the unprotected artillery crews. At 1800, as almost every night, the enemy began his pounding of the French artillery positions and of what was left of E1. And at 1820, Dien Bien Phu informed Hanoi that communist radio traffic seemed to indicate that troops were being relieved on the southwestern flanks, probably preparatory to a new push. In all, it had been a quiet Sunday. It was the last quiet Sunday the garrison of Dien Bien Phu was to experience. Monday, April 26, 1954. It also had been a relatively quiet night at Dien Bien Phu, except for the deadly accurate enemy flak. A strong patrol from the 12 REI, reinforced by recoilless rifle teams from the 35th Airborne Artillery, had pushed north as far as the ford on the road to Gabriel. On the ground, at least, the enemy seemed to have relaxed its grip for a time. In the air, the situation was different, however. With the American C-119 crews gone, Dien Bien Phu was slowly starving and bleeding to death. Instead of the 80 reinforcements expected that night, 4 French-piloted C-47s dropped only 36 men, and instead of the 150 tons of promised supplies, a total of 91 tons were dropped, with a 34% loss rate. That evening at 23:30, Navarre was to give his authorization to transfer French air crews from the C-47s to the C-119s. In the meantime, with fewer targets to shoot at, the Viet Minh flak had a field day. 50 airplanes were hit that day over Dien Bien Phu, and 3 shot down. At 10:30, 2 F-6F Hellcats of French Navy Fighter Squadron 11 were flying wing-to-wing on a low-level strafing run across Dien Bien Phu in an attempt at suppressing or at least diverting the enemy anti-aircraft artillery, which was creating havoc among the defenseless transport craft. Both pilots, Ensign Compredon and Petty Officer Robert, were experienced flyers. Compredon had flown 20 missions over Dien Bien Phu, and this was Petty Officer Robert's 9th. Both planes were about to pull out of the strafing run when the new batteries of 50-caliber anti-aircraft machine guns from Amery opened up on them. Compredon's aircraft, though hit, remained controllable, but Robert's Hellcat was hit so badly that the pilot immediately lost control. By a sheer miracle, he succeeded in opening his parachute and was seen by the garrison of Dien Bien Phu landing in the enemy-occupied hills to the west of Amery, too far away to be rescued by a French ground party. 8 years later, I was to see in Hanoi a brief film strip on the capture of Petty Officer Robert by the Viet Minh a few minutes later. The film showed an obviously shaken, very young man. At 20, he was the youngest fighter pilot of the squadron, still clad in flying suit, inflatable life vest, and white American flying helmet, standing at rigid attention before a stern-looking Viet Minh officer seated behind a table and who was obviously lecturing him. Robert was being accused of having committed barbarous acts and was told he deserved to die for them. All that the young pilot could think of saying is that he had not wanted that war.
"Well, then why did you fight in it?" asked the communist officer.
Robert's reply was one that was to become a classic for that sort of situation, and could still be heard in 1967 from the lips of American pilots shot down over North Vietnam. "I am a soldier. I obey orders." What happened a few minutes later was even more worrisome. A French B-26 bomber, flying at 2,900 meters, 9,000 feet, was shot clear out of the sky by Russian-made 37mm guns. No parachutes were seen. And at 1800, another B-26 bomber was shot down by communist flak southwest of Dien Bien Phu, but this time 3 parachutes were seen to open. None of them fell near enough to the French lines for a rescue attempt. This plane also had been flying at 9,000 feet. The news of the day's disaster in the air sounded in Hanoi like the crack of doom. Was it possible that the enemy now had received radar-guided anti-aircraft artillery? Or had the less experienced Vietnamese crews been replaced by Chinese flak gunners? In any case, it became obvious that the puny French bomber force with its 45 aircraft could not sustain such losses without disappearing in a matter of days. Not that aircraft aplenty were not available in the United States. The problem was still the shortage of bomber crews. Hence, Lieutenant Colonel Dussault, the Northern Bomber Commander, had to make do with what he had on hand. Even so, by incredible feats of ingenuity of the maintenance mechanics and endurance of the pilots, his 45 B-26s flew a total of 1,629 sorties between March 13th and May 7th, 1954. In his final report on the role of the bombers in the Battle of Dien Bien Phu, Dussault noted that the Viet Minh flak was better than the Nazi flak of World War II. That may have been considered at first as an exaggeration, or an attempt at explaining away what was, after all, above all, an air power failure. However, independent American appraisals bore out his view. In a report in October 1955 by Fairchild Corporation, the builder of the C-119, both the American civilian pilots who flew the Dien Bien Phu run and the Fairchild Field Service representatives agreed
that the flak encountered at Dien Bien Phu exceeded in intensity that met in Korea and was as dense as anything Allied pilots had encountered over the Ruhr during World War II. On the following day, the Commander-in-Chief of the French Far Eastern Air Force, General Lauzun, drew the only logical conclusion from the new situation. Absolute priority was assigned to flak-suppressing missions, at the expense of ground support and of the bombardment of Viet Minh supply lines. This could have been air power's finest hour at Dien Bien Phu. With 60 American B-29s standing by in the Philippines and about 400 jet fighters and light bombers standing offshore on the American aircraft carriers ready to intervene, it would have been possible for the French to concentrate on resupplying the garrison and on keeping Operation Condor alive. But that was not to be. Instead, as night fell, Dien Bien Phu resumed its litany of routine complaints. "Insist once more upon getting as soon as possible some medical corpsmen, trench periscopes, and bulletproof jackets for artillery personnel. Don't parachute in local auxiliaries. Request immediate reinforcements for White Tai. Also need one lieutenant for 1-2 Foreign Legion and one lieutenant for 1-13 Foreign Legion." A short while later, Dien Bien Phu noted a sudden intensification of communist artillery fire on the tortured artillery positions. Then, at 20:30, there came one single brief message from Dien Bien Phu, whose terseness in no way hid its impact upon the garrison. "We lose another 155mm gun." That left one single medium field piece in the valley, with about 300 rounds. For all practical purposes, French counter-battery, inasmuch as it ever existed, now was dead. Hundreds of miles away from the valley, between the northern headquarters at Hanoi, where General Coigny ruled, and the GHQ in Saigon, where General Navarre held forth, the icily polite exchange of teletype messages continued, each message covering under a thin mantle of administrative directness and military courtesy the feelings of pure hatred that both men now harbored for each other. To Coigny, Navarre was nothing but a narrow-minded armchair general who, for the sake of being unwilling to admit that he had erred in holding on to Dien Bien Phu, was going to sacrifice the key Red River Delta with its 180,000 troops, its 9 million industrious people, and its almost 3 million tons of precious rice. To Navarre, Major General Coigny, from a loyal subordinate, had become a self-seeking opportunist who was now totally disloyal to his commander, sabotaged his decisions at every turn, and made use of his long-standing good relations with the press corps to short-circuit his own commander's decisions and to make his own viewpoint heard everywhere. On either side, what was said or written now was for the sole purpose of establishing a record for a later duel on a grand scale before a board of inquiry, public opinion, courts of law, and history. Navarre's answer was extremely long and detailed, in contrast to Coigny, whose messages had become more and more involved and unclear as the situation deteriorated. Navarre's, who had been fairly unsure of himself at the beginning of the battle, now showed that he apparently again felt at home. The tactics of the situation were almost of no importance whatever. What counted were elements of information that belonged to the field of high-level political and military intelligence in which Navarre had spent much of his active life. In simple and clear terms, often reading like a professor's comment on a student's mildly obtuse term paper, Navarre went over the basics of the situation as it now stood. Contrary to Coigny's opinion, if I understand you correctly, that Dien Bien Phu no longer was worth an additional sacrifice of troops, Navarre felt that the overall situation warranted such sacrifices. At Geneva, the delegates of the forthcoming conference on Indochina were gathering that day and perhaps could produce a ceasefire which could save Dien Bien Phu from annihilation. Or conversely, the conference could fail altogether and could thus bring about an American last-minute intervention and save Dien Bien Phu literally on the brink of disaster. Navarre also demolished Coigny's other pet project of bringing relief to Dien Bien Phu by launching an offensive across the enemy's rear communication lines hundreds of kilometers away from Dien Bien Phu. Using facts and figures found in Coigny's own study of the operation, Navarre clearly demonstrated to him that the operation would have no immediate effect on the situation in Dien Bien Phu itself and would deprive the Delta of part of its present reserves, who in turn would have to face the onslaught of about 18 communist battalions already assembled in the area. And lastly, the whole operation would impose on the rest of Indochina a drain of key troops and aircraft that would have catastrophic effects elsewhere without bringing relief of any kind to the embattled Dien Bien Phu garrison. Finally, Navarre told Coigny that, contrary to the latter's advice, he would maintain the principle of carrying out Operation Condor. With that kind of total gap between the commander-in-chief and his key subordinate commander, any further dialogue was totally fruitless. Yet, to the last day, the exchange of messages continued, icily polite and totally unlikely to sway the recipients from their preconceived opinions, both of the situation and of each other. And to this day, both men have continued to hate each other. Before the French government's commission of inquiry, before the courts of Paris for a derogatory passage about Coigny in Navarre's book, before authors writing about Dien Bien Phu, and in the press. Coigny maintained in public his statement to Jules Roy that on April 2nd at about 1700 he had said to Navarre, "If you weren't a four-star general, I would slap you in the face." And Navarre, in another published communication, very transparently accused Coigny of having conspired, in Algeria, to murder the then commander-in-chief there, General Raoul Salan, with a bazooka. Tuesday, April 27, 1954. The combination of incredibly bad monsoon weather and enemy flak reduced the night drops of April 26th to 27th to a shambles. Only 50 volunteers were dropped in as reinforcements for the garrison. The high-altitude drops from C-119s, with the help of powder-trained delay fuses, proved, in the very words of the official supply report of that day, disastrous. One-third of the cargo was found by us. The rest fell into communist hands. But at long last, that part of the cargo which had fallen inside the French lines contained 200 flak jackets, while that same night another 100 fell on Strongpoint Isabelle. They were rapidly distributed to what was left of the artillery crews, and also to the paratroopers and legionnaires who were standing watch in the shell craters of Upper Allian. Captain Clédic's men received one flak jacket for every two men, and they immediately saved the lives of Sergeants Caron and Blado. They had dug a small niche into the trench wall and had hung the jacket over the entrance in curtain-like fashion. A mortar burst right in front of the opening shredded the jacket, but the two men survived without a scratch. At 0400, for the first time since the battle had begun in March, the din of the battle itself was temporarily overshadowed by the roar of what must have been hundreds of communist trucks north of the airfield. Taking advantage of the miserable flying weather, the Viet Minh had pushed its precious trucks all the way to the valley of Dien Bien Phu to bring in ammunition and push new artillery batteries closer to Dien Bien Phu itself. They could have been a tempting target for the French artillery, but the latter had to carefully husband its shells, and the last remaining 155 was so worn out that its shells would drop to the ground after only a few hundred yards, making a tired ploof sound in the soggy ground. The communists also attempted to renew their infiltrations around the ill-defended positions of Lille, C-5, and H-4. Enemy artillery maintained a steady bombardment on outlying C-5, and one of its patrols, out on ambush in the no-man's land, was in turn ambushed by the Viet Minh and sustained some losses. By noon, a new set of aerial photographs showed that the Viet Minh was pushing forward additional connecting trenches in the Huguet area and around E3. By now, communist sappers had worked out their siege tactics to the fine rhythm of a well-trained ballet. The lead element would dig a hole deep at the bottom of the trench and pass the earth to the rear, where it would be immediately used to fill sandbags. In the meantime, logs and wooden beams, which were somewhat wider than the mouth of the trench, would be brought forward and laid across the trench, thus providing the diggers almost immediately with fairly adequate overhead cover. And thus, the trench would extend its almost invisible underground tentacle toward the French wire entanglements, and often would simply dig underneath the French minefield. Over on Allian, Bressignac's men now could clearly pick up the noise of communist sappers digging deep under the hill. Thanks to their crude geophones, which were composed simply of a combination of French Army wine canteens and medical stethoscopes, the scraping and digging could be heard without difficulty, just as it could be heard by the Germans atop Messines Ridge in Flanders almost 40 years earlier, when miners from Wales were digging away under it to blast the Germans out. The difference was that the Germans did have the possibility of countermining. On Allian, the garrison was busy enough simply trying to stay alive and keep a few of the remaining firing positions and bunkers in shape. In fact, this was not a bad day for the French at all, as in the morning, a strong foreign legion patrol once more wound its way through the minefields south of Huguet and west of Claudine, across the main Viet Minh circumferential trench, and on to Bang Co Mai. There was surprisingly little communist resistance in that direction, and it is likely that these patrols, even if they did not know it, were in fact reconnoitering the most suitable escape routes from Dien Bien Phu, should Operation Albatross be given the green light. The French were also lucky in another sector. On top of the Alliance, Captain Marcel Kledik had put together an assault team for a strong reconnaissance in the area between E1 and E4. Mounted by volunteers from the 2-1 RCP and 2nd Company 5th Vietnamese paratroops, the raid succeeded beautifully. The Vietnamese paratroopers blew up 3 Viet Minh bunkers, 12 enemy soldiers were killed by both the Vietnamese and the French, and 3 bewildered Bo Doi were brought back into camp alive for interrogation. They confirmed what French intelligence already had relayed to Hanoi and Saigon, and what could be simply termed a crisis in Viet Minh combat morale. That this was in fact so, and not simply a morale-boosting operation of some French staff officers in dire need of reporting something cheerful in the midst of an otherwise gloomy period, was finally confirmed in March 1965 by the enemy itself. In a small study issued in Hanoi and dealing with the Battle of Dien Bien Phu as seen from the North Vietnamese viewpoint, there appears an entry under the dateline of April 27th, whose text reads as follows. In Dien Bien Phu, after discovering erroneous tendencies which affected the fulfillment of our tasks, the Front Military Committee held a conference of party for secretaries of divisions and regiments to launch a campaign for moral mobilization and rectification of rightist tendencies. In plain English, this meant that once more some of the communist Vietnamese unit commanders were beset by doubts. Perhaps there was more to Operation Condor than appeared at first glance, and at least part of the Dien Bien Phu siege force would have to be diverted to face it. Moreover, the Western press was full of rumors, some from highly authoritative sources, about the possibility and even likelihood of an American air intervention around Dien Bien Phu. If such an intervention were to occur, it would literally catch tens of thousands of the Viet Minh's best infantrymen in the open, and would surely also result in the total destruction of the huge communist supply depots in the Tuan Giao region. Also, a perfectly sound communist division commander could argue, a prolonged resistance of Dien Bien Phu could well be in the process of achieving what the French had wanted to achieve, to buy time to organize the defense of the vital Red River Delta while drawing away the bulk of the enemy's battle force to a jungle valley in the middle of nowhere. Dien Bien Phu perhaps was expensive to the French in terms of the strain it represented on a notoriously weak logistical support system, but, as Navarre was to point out repeatedly, the garrison represented only 4% of the total French Union forces available in Indochina, and that small fraction of the French forces kept tied down for almost half a year 5 communist divisions, that is, 60% of their total main battle force and almost 1/5 of all their military manpower, part-time guerrillas included. It probably took all the eloquence and authority that Giap could muster to rectify the views of the doubters, and the divisional and regimental political commissars who had come to the meeting of the Front Military Committee and who now had to return to their units must have pondered at the difficulty of their situation, since, as it turned out, it would now be their task to ask the troops and the subordinate military commanders to make yet one more desperate effort to finish off the grimly determined French resistance on the blood-soaked hills and in the filth-laden valley bottom of Dien Bien Phu. Wednesday, April 28, 1954. The monsoon now prevailed in full force, making the parachuting of personnel and supplies almost impossible. It did not, of course, stop the effectiveness of the Viet Minh anti-aircraft artillery, which was simply firing at the obligatory course that all aircraft had to fly on approaching Dien Bien Phu. As a result, only 1 24-man stick of foreign legionnaires succeeded in landing between 0015 and 0200, and not at the main position, but at Isabel only. For totally incomprehensible reasons, the Air Force then decided to stop the dropping of supplies altogether. Isabel received perhaps a total of 22 tons. Dien Bien Phu, on that particular day, received nothing. As dawn came, a thick blanket of clouds, solidly anchored against all the hills surrounding the valley, made tactical air support impossible. No fighter or bomber flew over the position on that day. Dien Bien Phu had never been as alone as on April 28. The French tanks continued their duel with the enemy's recoilless rifles atop Dominique, and Lieutenant Colonel Hubert de Seguin-Pazy, who had become de Castries' chief of staff on April 23 as a replacement for the ailing de Creux, told Colonel Bastiani, Coney's chief of staff, on the radio telephone that the parachuting of reinforcements was imperative at Dien Bien Phu for the next night and for Isabelle on the night of April 29 to 30. Bastiani promised to do his best. On the following day, Coney sent a message to General Navarre requesting permission to use C-119s on low-level missions over Dien Bien Phu. For once, a note of humanity crept into the communications between the two generals, as Coney pleaded, "The very existence of Dien Bien Phu is at stake. I have the honor of requesting an extremely urgent decision in the matter." That evening, at 2200, Giraud's paratroopers from H-4 crawled through the barbed wire in direction of the 1st Viet Minh approach trenches, overwhelmed the enemy sentries in one swift movement, killed the occupants of the trench, and returned to their own lines with only 3 wounded of their own. At least 20 Viet Minh were killed. Among the remnants of the crack units holding out on the perimeter, there was still hope. The troops knew about Crèvecoeur's column in Laos, and they also knew about the negotiations in Geneva. There was more contempt than discouragement in their reaction to what they considered the failure of the outside world to support them. Thursday, April 29, 1954. The rains again fell all night, and a short message to Hanoi reported as a matter of course that the average depth of mud in the trenches now reached 1 meter, 3 feet. At 0025, Brezhnev from atop Elion unleashed an artillery and mortar barrage on communist trench diggers to the east of E2. The barrage was followed up by patrols, who reported that about 40 dead Viet Minh were found in the trenches. At dawn, the deplorable results of the monsoon on the supply and troop reinforcements began to show up in the headquarters reports. Less than 30 tons of supplies had arrived, and, contrary to the promises made, not a single soldier had been parachuted. At dawn, it was the turn of Major Touré's 8th BPC on Sparrowhawk to request a barrage on communist trench diggers. It, too, was followed by an infantry counterattack from both Sparrowhawk and the unnamed strongpoint in the drainage ditch, which succeeded in filling in a few yards of freshly dug trenches. As the battle seesawed around Sparrowhawk, a small explosion suddenly shook the air in front of E2. A lone Foreign Legion volunteer from the 113 Half Brigade had crawled down the shell-pocked slope of E2 with a rucksack of plastic explosives and had blown up a communist forward bunker. This finally led Giap to react. An intensive communist artillery bombardment began to cover the whole center of Dien Bien Phu and within a few minutes found its mark. A shell from the ubiquitous 75mm recoilless rifles on Dominique killed Master Sergeants Desia and Mitri of the Air Force Detachment, while elsewhere in the camp 8 other men were killed and 26 wounded. And as always, when all of Dien Bien Phu was blanketed by heavy communist fire, the depots were hit. On April 26th, 200 daily food rations had been lost when a shelled food depot burned, and now, with an ear-shattering roar, 600 artillery shells and a truck blew up, leaving a ghastly crater, which soon was to form a lake, of course, and depleting even more of the slim ammunition reserves of the fortress. With the absence of parachuted supplies, the garrison, except for the seriously wounded, went on half food rations. Not that it mattered. Most of the Frenchmen were now, like the Vietnamese, living on rice and Nuoc Mam, the pungent Vietnamese fish sauce, which, when mixed with a small can of French Army corned beef, referred to among the connoisseurs because of the somewhat undefined origin of its contents as monkey meat, proved to be over the short run an acceptable diet. At 0940, the already heavy communist fire reached a new crescendo as yet another 5 Viet Minh 75mm recoilless guns revealed themselves on the western face of Dominique. What was new about them was that they did not fire from the top of the hill, nor were they positioned in an open gun pit. After days of patient digging, the Viet Minh coolies had dug long mine shafts through the whole hill from the protected reverse slope, and the gunners could hit the whole French position with impunity from almost totally invisible gun ports. There was an incident of non-military nature which preoccupied the senior commanders at Dien Bien Phu that day also. On April 23rd, the highly respected French daily Le Figaro had published an article under the title of Could 100 Airplanes Save Dien Bien Phu? The gist of the article was that while 100 additional planes could perhaps not guarantee a permanent survival of the French garrison, they could in all likelihood ensure the garrison's survival for several more weeks and perhaps through the forthcoming negotiations. The article, obviously based on French government inside information, stated quite accurately that France simply no longer had the potential to provide the airlines and crews, and forecast, again quite accurately, that the United States, who could provide those airplanes and crews, would not do so. Within a few days, clippings of the article began to appear in the mail that the troops received from home, and parts of it also had been read over Radio Hirondelle, the French Army broadcasting station in Hanoi, which was regularly listened to throughout the garrison. In his message on the subject, De Castries, they may have been, in fact, Longley's words, but over the signature of the fortress commander, complained bitterly of the catastrophic effect on the morale of the combatants of that article and others in a similar vein, and added, "Why don't you get censorship to work on that?" While the request was understandable under the circumstances, it was of course impossible to carry out. It would have meant opening and searching every single piece of mail going to Dien Bien Phu, with resulting delays in delivery, and in the absence of any other contact with the outside world, the airdrops of mail constituted a far too precious boost to morale to be lightly tampered with. In any case, it is somewhat doubtful that the newspaper articles in themselves had a determining influence upon the combatants on the firing line. The chief surgeon at Dien Bien Phu, Dr. Groin, tells the story of one paratroop volunteer who had jumped into the fortress late in April and who had handed him the French newspaper whose front page carried a banner headline calling Dien Bien Phu an incredible tactical and political mistake. "And you came anyway, after having read this?" asked Groin. "Well," said the newly parachuted volunteer, "you don't really think that I'm going to bug out because of some stuff printed in some rag?" Also, on April 29th, at 1800, Lieutenant Geneviève de Gallard was ordered to report to the command post of GAP 2. Weeks ago, Geneviève had abandoned her French Air Force coveralls for a more practical paratroop uniform cut down to her size. Since the GAP 2 was near the hospital, she had in the past received such invitations and considered a visit with the paratroopers a welcome break from the depressing routine of the underground hospital. But when she lifted the blackout curtain and entered Longley's dugout, an unexpected scene awaited her. There were, in addition to Longley, General De Castries, Lieutenant Colonel Lemounier, and Majors Bijard and Vadeau rising from benches and chairs as she entered. De Castries stepped forward, picked up something, and said, "Geneviève, I've got something for you," and he then pronounced the French ritual formula to be used when a high decoration is being awarded. "By virtue of the powers conferred upon me," and pinned a croix de guerre with palms, and next to it, the white enamel cross with the blood-red ribbon of the Knight's Cross of the Legion of Honor. It had not been easy to hold that ceremony, for almost no one had any medals at Dien Bien Phu. Longley himself managed to find a battered croix de guerre in one of his own footlockers, and one of his lieutenants kindly lent his recently awarded Legion of Honor for the ceremony. There was no one at Dien Bien Phu who did not feel that Geneviève de Gallard had earned her decorations. Out in the falling darkness, where the battle continued, Tank Douaumont, which had been dueling with the recoilless rifles of Dominique, sustained a direct hit by a 105mm shell. Its whole crew became casualties, and the pierced hulk was dragged over to Huguette 3 to serve as a fixed bunker. That left exactly one tank, Auerstedt, from Sergeant Ney's old platoon, in full working order. Friday, April 30th, 1954. That Friday was the holiest of holidays for the 2,400-odd foreign legionnaires in Dien Bien Phu's main position as well, and it well-nigh turned out to be a holiday for almost everybody. For that was the day when the American air crews from CAT decided, in view of the desperate straits of the Dien Bien Phu garrison, to return to their flying boxcars. The French Air Force had promised them that it would make a more determined effort to suppress enemy flak, a promise it failed to keep, and thus the sky above Dien Bien Phu was filled with the drone of almost 100 aircraft as the total supply tonnage carried to Dien Bien Phu that day reached the almost all-time high of 212 tons. One element, however, troubled that bright picture. The C-119s now were kicking out their loads at an altitude of 10,000 feet, with a corresponding loss of precision in the drops. The allegation was made later by one source that the drops were landing with surprising accuracy on a DZ only 330 yards square, but the French Air Force officially conceded that almost one-third of the day's drop, or about 65 tons, had fallen into enemy territory. On the ground, Dien Bien Phu claimed that almost one-half of the total load had fallen into enemy hands. The likely fact of the matter was that several tens of tons of supplies technically fell into friendly hands, but in places where they could not be collected, minefields, barbed wire entanglements, or in areas completely beaten by communist fire. One such situation that day was to have humorous side effects. At 2200, De Castries headquarters reported to Hanoi a successful raid on the communist trenches and fortifications south of E2 by Major Coutant's 113 Foreign Legion. One Viet Minh blockhouse was completely destroyed with plastic charges, and two others were severely damaged. In addition, at least 10 enemy soldiers were killed and others were wounded, while there were no friendly losses to report. The communiqué, however, failed to stress that the idea of the raid originated in the fact that two complete crates of Vinogel wine concentrate had fallen into no man's land east of the Elion ridgeline held by the Legionnaires. The Legionnaires, who thus far that day had had to celebrate Camerone with exactly one bottle of wine per platoon, were not about to let that precious booty fall into enemy hands. A commando of volunteers was organized, as one non-Legionnaire observed. Everybody would have volunteered for that raid, and as soon as night fell, pushed off into no man's land. The main objective was rapidly secured, the knocking out of the enemy bunkers being a mere tactical necessity incident to the success of the operation. But Camerone was also celebrated elsewhere in Dien Bien Phu. On battered Claudine, not even Vinogel was available, and the diary of the 1st Battalion, 2nd Foreign Legion, noted tersely, "A Camerone without wine or blood sausage, a traditional dish for that holiday." But the main ceremony was at the command post of the 13th Half Brigade, with Lieutenant Colonel Lemounier acting as the host in his capacity as both the most senior Legionnaire in the fortress and the Legionnaire with the longest service in all of North Vietnam. Lemounier, miraculously impeccable in a full-dress uniform with perfectly shined shoes, read the traditional Camerone proclamation over a radio hookup that could be heard throughout the fortress, and then proceeded with the honorary induction into the Foreign Legion of a few non-Legionnaires, another ancient tradition which permitted the person so honored to wear his Foreign Legion rank insignia, no matter how exalted his real rank was. According to tradition, each person so honored is presented to the Legion by a Legionnaire who acts as his godfather, and whose serial number, followed by the suffix V, would become his own. That morning, De Castries and Longley became honorary corporals of the Half Brigade, and Bijard and Jean-Vive de Galard became PFCs. Mademoiselle de Galard's godfather was Major Vadeau's Batman. As she walked out, she turned to him and said, "If we ever get out of this alive, I'll pay you a bottle of champagne, no matter where we meet." In 1963, she was riding in an automobile in Paris with her husband when she recognized the Legionnaire walking along the sidewalk. She stopped, embraced him, and made good on her promise. Along the perimeter, however, there were signs of increased communist activity. Between 0600 and 0630, a small Viet Minh force raided Major Chanel's Algerian company on D3. Three Algerians were killed, but 12 communist bodies were left on the barbed wire. South of Junot, the small strong point held entirely by the Air Force detachment, a few tribesmen, and 400 wounded, communist activity was reported for the first time within a distance of 800 meters. A reconnaissance which that night attempted to push to Ban Co Mai made contact with the enemy at Ban Pa Pei, a good kilometer closer to Dien Bien Phu. But the enemy was also taking a measure of punishment. During the wine raid around E2, the Legionnaires had found a thoroughly frightened 16-year-old cowering in a forward trench and had brought him back with them. When interrogated by intelligence, he turned out to be a raw recruit who had been drafted into the People's Army on April 8th and who had arrived at Dien Bien Phu only a few days earlier. He did not even know what unit he belonged to and stated that French air raids on the Viet Minh depots and convoys along Road 41 were devastatingly effective in destroying many trucks and killing a great many coolies. Perhaps another 100 aircraft would have made a difference at Dien Bien Phu. Saturday, May 1st, 1954. This first night of May brought with itself surprisingly little anti-aircraft fire, but much probing on the ground. A total of only 43 volunteers jumped in, however, and the heavy transports, now back to full strength, kept up a steady drone of aircraft engines over the valley. By the end of the day, 197 tons had been loaded aboard the aircraft for Dien Bien Phu, but at 16:30, 3rd Bureau, Operations, reported to its counterpart in Hanoi, with a note of despair, that something must have gone wrong with the powder train delay fuses. 50% of the airdrops are parachute failures due to premature opening. Two C-119s just turned around without even dropping their loads. On the ground, in the meantime, Battalion 227 of Infantry Regiment 322, People's Army Division 308, attacked the Foreign Legion paratroopers who had been holding onto H-5 now for over a week. But Giraud's paratroopers knew only too well that would happen if the communists were left to get organized on their position. The battalion began its counterattack in a driving rain at 02:30 and immediately called for protective artillery fires from the howitzers of the 310 RAC of Captain Libier at Isabelle. By 0600, the communist penetration was disintegrating, but a few hardy elements still hung on close to the edges of H-5, and a reserve company from the 12 REI took the subway northward to reinforce the counterattack. By 0800, even the approach trenches to H-5 had been cleared in bloody hand-to-hand fighting, and at 1000, the situation could be considered fully established. When the second wave of supply drops, which had begun at 1200, ended at 1415 without much interference from the flak, everybody became convinced that something serious was afoot. There were other indications, moreover. From listening in on enemy radio traffic, French intelligence believed that 6 battalions had been involved in the various probes of the last 2 days. Particularly on the eastern flank, signs of an imminent attack by major forces became ominous. A prisoner captured that day near E1 declared he belonged to the 812th Company of Battalion 88 of Regiment 176 of the 316th People's Army Division. He had been at Dien Bien Phu exactly 3 days. And another prisoner captured on D3 declared that he had been a member of Battalion 166, Regiment 209 of the 312th Division. But just as April 30th had been a holiday in the valley of Dien Bien Phu, May 1st was a holiday in the hills around it. It was Labor Day throughout much of the Western world, except in the United States, and in all of the communist countries, and Giap's army celebrated it accordingly. There were thousands of blood-red Labor Day flags flying all over the communist positions, sometimes stuck in the ground, and in other cases hung on trees, and in a few cases waving from rifles held high above the trench works. Music could also be heard from loudspeakers installed in the communist positions. But as the day wore on, it became clear that the enemy was on the move. The forward observers with their high-powered field glasses could see communist infantry reinforcements moving forward. Even artillery pieces were being moved about in full view, despite the fact that the B-26s of the French Air Force were operating over the valley for the first time with new American hail bombs, a new type of fragmentation bomb filled with razor-sharp steel shards designed specifically to be used against personnel caught in the open. As there had been on Saturday, March 13th, there was in the air a deadly smell of general attack, and this time the French knew that they would not be able to resist it. Inside Dien Bien Phu, supply and personnel were lining up their facts and figures as far as food and ammunition were concerned. The last 2 days of record drops had been a godsend. There were now again 3 days of food available, 275 rounds of 155mm ammunition, 5,000 rounds of 120mm mortar ammunition, and 14,000 rounds of 105mm shells for the howitzers. That might sound like a lot of ammunition, except for the fact that as the French knew from the dire experiences of the general attacks of March 13th and March 31st, once the battle was engaged, those stocks would melt like butter in the sun. During the 36 hours of fighting on March 13th to 14th, the French artillery had fired 14,300 rounds of 105 and 13,000 rounds of 120mm ammunition, and in one single day of fighting on March 31st, the 105mm howitzers had expended 13,000 shells and the heavy mortars 3,000. In other words, if the new attack was to be as ferocious as the others, and there was every reason to believe that, if anything, it would be worse, then the French would either run out of ammunition altogether within 24 hours, or simply would have to keep an iron lid on ammunition consumption, no matter how urgent was the begging for fire support on the firing line. To be sure, a new maximum effort could be asked from the Air Force, that is, provided it could find the necessary air crews to fly the missions, and provided the bad monsoon weather did not make air action altogether ineffective. In the personnel dugout, the head of that service, Lieutenant Colonel Trancar, also had a few telling figures. From April 17th to April 24th, Dien Bien Phu had lost a total of about 1,000 combatants, either dead or seriously wounded, and had received a total of 432 parachuted reinforcements. It had therefore lost a net of 568 men. From April 24th, which marked the beginning of the period of relative calm, until the morning of May 1st, the fortress had lost another 82 dead and 345 seriously wounded, for a total of 427. During that period, it had received a total of 251 parachuted reinforcements. And these losses did not yet include the very heavy casualties of the counterattacks launched during the night of April 30th to May 1st, both at Isabelle to retake Strongpoint Wheme and on the main position to clear up the communist penetration on H5. Isabelle reported 4 killed and 18 wounded, and the Foreign Legion Composite Paratroop Battalion had lost 12 killed, 68 seriously wounded, and 8 missing. In other words, there were probably less than 2,900 first-line combatants left at Dien Bien Phu, about one-third of what had been available on March 13th, and they were haggard remnants of once-proud units burned to a hollow shell in 49 days of fighting. The bare statistical facts told a more eloquent story than any long report. The French at Dien Bien Phu were doomed in case of a massive enemy attack unless massive reinforcements, and not dribbles of men, became available immediately. It was obvious that the feeding in of 600 isolated individuals who had never met each other and who did not know their platoon leaders, let alone their battalion commanders, was not the equivalent of supplying a 600-man battalion that could be thrown into the battle as a constituted unit, even if the state of individual training in both groups was equal. This was the sense of a long and almost incoherent radio message that Colonel Longley sent at 1700 to Colonel Sauvignac, the commander of the paratroop rear base in Hanoi. Longley demanded the immediate dropping in of fully constituted airborne units. The end of the message gives a good idea of the whole. "We will win the battle without you and in spite of you. This message, copy of which I shall transmit to all airborne battalion commanders here, will be the last I shall address to you." But a few minutes before the message was tapped out by the radio operator, the thunderous roar of 100 or more field guns had filled the air, and a few seconds later the ground had begun to shake on Claudine and Huguet, in the command posts and the hospitals, among the wounded on Juno, and in the open holes of the PIM camp. General Vo Nguyen Giap's final attack on Dien Bien Phu had begun. His artillery was laying down the first preparatory fires. On Upper Elian, Major Bréchignac had spent the day shifting his few remaining paratroop companies for maximum effectiveness. His command post, as Bijar's before him, was installed on E4, and Captain Botella of the 5th BPVN now was his executive officer. As for the 5th itself, it had ceased to exist as such. Captain Bizarre had a small company with him in the drainage ditch north of Sparrowhawk, and up on E1 there remained a small 80-man company of Vietnamese paratroopers under a Vietnamese officer, Pham Van Phu. He was 21 years old and had just received a battlefield promotion to the rank of captain. On E1, Captain Kledik, after 2 hellish days atop the hill, moved to the rear with the remains of his company, while Lieutenant Leguerre relieved him with the 3rd Company, and Lieutenant Perriot's 1st Company went on counterattack alert. On E2, the 113 of Major Couton was also holding firm. Plowed under beyond recognition, the hill had held throughout the battle, and the enemy had developed an almost superstitious fear of what it called A1, or the 5th Hill. That night, Sergeant Kubiak was on guard at the southernmost bunker of E2, when, in the greenish light of the parachute flares, there appeared what seemed to be a ghost in no man's land, a human figure all draped in white. One of Kubiak's legionnaires, without further ado, jumped over the parapet and grabbed the apparition. The man, a Vietnamese draped in a white nylon parachute, allowed himself to be taken without the slightest resistance and walked with his escort to the French bunker. As he came closer, Kubiak gave him a brief glance and then jumped him, knocking him to the ground. The Vietnamese was a Viet Minh death volunteer and a walking human bomb. The bulky parachute hid heavy loads of explosives affixed to his back and chest, which he was to detonate upon reaching the French position. When he was interrogated, he told the French that the little bunker had considerably hindered the communist advance on Allianz and that he had volunteered to immolate himself to destroy it. By nightfall, the communist fires on the central position shifted to D3 and E4 and simply boxed in what was left of the garrisons on the slopes of the northern part of Upper Allianz. And at 20:00, the better part of two communist divisions, the 312th and the 316th, began to storm the two hills. On Dominique 3, Chanel simply never had a chance, with his ragtag force of Thai tribesmen and demoralized Algerians barely stiffened by the one company of Major Thomas' 6th BPC. Still, now that they knew that the fate of Dien Bien Phu depended upon them, the Algerians also fought to the end. At 0200 of May 2nd, it was all over for Dominique 3. It was out of ammunition and covered with the dead and dying of its own garrison, and there were no reserves or spare ammunition to be had anywhere in the fortress. On E1, these were the final minutes for the 2nd Battalion, 1st French Parachute Regiment. Lieutenant Leguerre grimly held on to the top of E1 in hand-to-hand combat, but at 20:15 requested reinforcements, and Bressignac ordered Lieutenant Peru's 1st Company to join Leguerre and his men. But the attack was now unfolding in the northwestern sector as well. Four completely new communist batteries, totaling 16 105mm howitzers, positioned in full view a mere 3 kilometers from the center of Dien Bien Phu, now opened up on Huguette and were soon reinforced by a deluge of shells from the heavy 120mm communist mortars which had re-entered the battle that day. After some diversionary probes on Lili 2 and some small infiltrations between Huguettes 2, 3, and 4, the burden of the communist attack suddenly concentrated again on outlying Huguette 5. There, after a day's intermittent shelling and an hour's intensive artillery preparation, Lieutenant de Stavenrath had only 29 able-bodied men when the first assault waves of the 308th People's Army Division rose out of the trenches. At 20:05, Dien Bien Phu reported H5 as fallen. Lieutenant de Stavenrath, who already had been wounded before, was wounded once more before H5 was submerged. He died a few weeks later in a communist prison camp. Long before midnight, the senior commanders in Dien Bien Phu knew that the final assault had come, and that, short of a miracle, they would not be able to resist it. The message sent at 20:05 simply reeled off the obituary of strong points fallen or attacked, and of units destroyed, and added the comment, "No more reserves left. Fatigue and wear and tear on the units terrible. Supplies and ammunition insufficient. Quite difficult to resist one more such push by communists, at least without bringing in one brand new battalion of excellent quality." That latter point was again stressed in a personal message sent by de Castri to Cogny at 23:45. "In any case, extremely heavy losses require, as of tomorrow night, a solid new battalion. Urgent reply requested." That night, General Cogny made up his mind. The last battalion of the Airborne Reserve, the 1st Colonial Parachute, BPC, of Captain Guy de Bazin de Bazon, would be dropped into Dien Bien Phu during the night of May 2nd. General Cogny originates from Normandy, a province whose people are known in France for their proverbial caution in making up their minds. In fact, Cogny, as already mentioned earlier, would invoke that Norman trait of prudence in explaining some of his actions. In the present case, the commitment of his last parachute battalion was a prudent measure indeed, but it had come a few days too late. In France, U.S. Air Force Globemasters of the 62nd Troop Carrier Wing, under the command of Major Michael F. Robinson, began to airlift 450 French paratroops issued directly from the paratroop training schools at Pau and Vannes to Indochina. It was a grueling trip half around the earth, and it was made in vain. They arrived in Indochina on the day Dien Bien Phu fell. Sunday, May 2, 1954. As the night wore on, it was clear to Bressignac that he would not receive any additional reserves to hold on to E1, but neither was it possible to disengage what was left of its garrison. It was being massacred man by man. Lieutenant Leguerre was wounded sometime after midnight, and Lieutenant Perrieux was killed shortly after the arrival of his company on the hill. At 0207, Dien Bien Phu reported E1 and D3 as completely fallen, and H4 under attack. H4 was held by a mixed company of Foreign Legion paratroopers under Captain John Luciani, the same officer who had held Elion 2 for over 60 hours at the beginning of April. Huguet was being strangled by communist approach trenches. Communist snipers seemed to be everywhere in the triangle between H2, H3, and H4, and for all practical purposes, Luciani's little band seemed to be cut off from the rear. But the enemy had taken frightening losses as well, and his aggressiveness definitely slackened off at 0200. At 0250, the Viet Minh resumed its attack, but this time with an emphasis on the Foreign Legionnaires on top of E2, and at 0305, the Knight's second attack began on H4, but Couthon, Giraud, and Luciani all stood their ground. On E2, the fight developed into hand-to-hand combat in the forward trenches around the south bunker, while on H4, the last remaining movable tank and a mixed force of legionnaires from H3 and Moroccans from Major Nicolas' strongpoint Lili 2 reoccupied the trenches covering the rear of H4. By 0625, all penetrations on E2 and E4 had been cleared, and H4 was again holding. But the price for the night had been frightening. On Upper Elion, the loss of Dominique 3 and Elion 1 was an irreparable tragedy. The remaining hill positions, E2, E3, and E4, were hopelessly outflanked, and with the loss of D3, every shred of Dien Bien Phu was under permanent observation of the enemy and under his direct fire. And the human losses were of the kind that simply forbade the kind of counterattacks which, 1 month earlier, still succeeded in clearing E1 and E2. As Francard added up the losses for that one night, they told a story eloquent beyond words. 28 known killed, including an officer, 168 wounded in French hands, including an officer, 303 missing, including 6 officers. One battalion had been lost, and if it was very lucky, Dien Bien Phu would receive a battalion to replace it in the course of the following night. But Dien Bien Phu was not lucky. Instead of a battalion, it received at 0250 of May 3rd, the 107 men of Lieutenant Marcel Edma's 2nd Company, 1st Colonial Paratroop Battalion. Edma had started his military career as a Free French member of the elite commandos of the British Special Air Service, SAS, and still wore the distinctive dark red beret of his British unit. Colonel Longley had been his commander a year earlier in France and knew him well. He also knew that Edma's wife, a nurse in Hanoi, was expecting a baby any day. Longley scribbled out a short message for her, indicating that Edma had arrived safely, and then assigned him to reinforce the legionnaires on E2. Having received a total of 107 troops as reinforcements, the French were to lose about 420 men that day. At 10:20, Dien Bien Phu reported that it was regrouping its units under light artillery fire, and added, "No more reserves left, extreme fatigue and weariness of all concerned." By 12:20, the units had been regrouped, and E10 and E12, which were now on the firing line, had been reinforced with wounded who had been scraped together in the various underground hospitals. A decade later, Dr. Gouin still recalled his amazement at the sight of heavily bandaged men requesting to be returned to their units. "If we've got to croak, we might as well croak with our buddies," was a view which they expressed very often. Captain Luciani was a good example of what was meant. Wounded 3 times, he was now commanding H4 with a heavy bandage over one of his eyes, which had been removed. The only good news of the day was that far to the south, Isabelle had succeeded in retaking strongpoint Wheim, but at Dien Bien Phu, the garrison was again treated to the sight of distressingly poor supply drops. At 1400, 2 C-119s dropped their complete loads of 6 tons each into enemy lines, and much of the rest, perhaps as much as 50%, fell into places where it could not be retrieved. Yet, as always, part of the battle took place far away from Dien Bien Phu, on the airfields of North Vietnam, and in the staff offices of the Hanoi Citadel, where the headquarters of the Northern Command was located. On the 3 key airfields in the Red River Delta, and aboard the 2 available aircraft carriers, the situation had reached the breaking point. On April 30th, Captain Patou's aircraft carrier Aramanche had been relieved by Captain Morneau's newly arrived carrier Belleau Wood, which the United States had lent the French Navy for service in Indochina and which was now manned by a French crew. It had brought from France Squadron 14F, Lieutenant Menetrier, equipped with American Corsair dive bombers, and was to take over from the Aramanche the pilots of Squadron 11F, who had been in combat over Dien Bien Phu for the past 4 months. But then the Aramanche's doctors stepped in and requested the grounding of the squadron, with the exception of 2 recently arrived pilots, on medical grounds. Of 20 pilots, at least 6 had been shot down, 3 of the latter had been killed and 1 taken prisoner. All the others had either seen their plane seriously damaged or had had to crash land them at least once.